The issue I come to order today is March 12, 2009. We're going to go just a little out of order today. The first item on the agenda will be House Bill 2991. Representative Witt.
House Bill 2991 exempts a transfer of a firearm for performing criminal history record check if the purchaser or recipient has a concealed handgun license.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Brad Witt, State Representative from House District 31, appearing today in support of House Bill 2991. Representative Gelser, who is also a co-sponsor of the bill, is in another meeting, or another hearing room, rather, testifying at this very moment, and indicated that she's going to try and get here. So I also apologize, Mr. Chairman, that my two expert witnesses that were going to appear last hearing were unable to show up today. It puts me at somewhat of a disadvantage in that I don't know the technicalities, background checks themselves. Those witnesses did. I believe there'll be other folks appearing today that may be able to provide some technical background should those questions arise. As the council pointed out, this bill is very straightforward. It would exempt concealed handgun licensees from background checks when they desire to purchase a firearm in this state. With that, one of my previous expert witnesses, Greg Smith, who is an NRA firearms instructor and also trains folks in concealed carry as well as providing concealed classes, suggests that there are two areas or two amendments that would be appropriate for this bill before he would in essence give his personal endorsement. It's his feeling that if we pass a law, we need to get it right, and I share his opinion, Mr. Chairman. Those two amendments in brief. One, there would be a potential loophole, as the bill's currently written, in the instance where a licensee changed his or her address, moved to a new county, and committed a crime that would, in essence, bar them from entitlement to a CHL. In that instance, when there is a move to a new county, the new county submit a set of fingerprints to the background check system, because it is that county of record where notification goes. It is my understanding that's where notification goes if someone commits a crime. So that would cover that particular loophole. There is one other loophole in that in the instance where someone would have committed a crime in the last couple of days, and there wasn't adequate time for notification to go back to the county of record about that crime, then Mr. Smith's recommendation is that a phone call be made to that county of record to verify that CHL is in fact still valid.
Okay, thank you. And I would just tell you that if somebody's license, if they, for example, somebody gets a drunk driving license, they live in Washington County. Washington County immediately suspends their license. They call the state police and say, Mr. Johnson's license has been revoked on the spot. So then, and even if the person, for instance, was working in this building, the state police would come over and say, we'd like your license back. So they do protect that. But your other point is very well taken. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as I've been able to discern, those are the only two loopholes that I've heard from anyone on that were of concern to folks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have amendments presented to us? Oh, okay.
Mr. Sterrett, Mr. Harder, and Mr. Volstead.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. We support the bill. The one amendment we were going to suggest is in the event of a situation where a license had been revoked but not seized by the sheriff, which happens, that the state police be available to, a call to the state police be make, excuse me, would be possible to make a call to the state police determining the validity of the license. In my conversations with state police ID unit, they say that they feel comfortable that they can do that. So I would suggest that that be considered, that in lieu of a background check, a call just be made, is so-and-so's license valid? At that point, no further check would be necessary.
Thank you. Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rod Harder with the National Rifle Association. We're here in support of the bill also, with several caveats, one which Representative Witt brought forward, and we also had concerns about a CHL not being valid at the time the purchase was made. If those kind of amendments were made, we would be in full support of the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Matt Bolstad with PacWest, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Gun Owners Association, and we would like to register our strong support for HB 2991. An Oregonian with a concealed handgun license has already undergone one of the toughest screenings in the country. According to statute, such a person has already proven to law enforcement that they are a citizen, at least 21 years of age, has a principal residence in the county of issuance, no outstanding warrants, is not free on any form of pretrial release, completed a certified safety course, not been found guilty of a misdemeanor or felony, not been institutionalized for mental illness, and not been dishonorably discharged from the military. In addition, they have paid $15 to the state police for running their fingerprints and $50 to the sheriff's office for issuing the license, plus any fees associated with their safety course. Then kept on file is the entirety of their application, with physical description and other personal information like date of birth, home address, and fingerprint. I understand that you may be concerned with persons who commit crimes post-issuance of the concealed handgun permit, that those people could still purchase firearms. First, the right to carry population in Oregon is overwhelmingly law-abiding, as you heard from the sheriffs on Tuesday. For the few that do commit a misdemeanor or felony and are convicted, their concealed carrying license is revoked. Such persons would not be able to purchase a firearm without passing the standard checks, and they can never again have the right to carry in Oregon. In talking with the sheriffs, it's my understanding that a warrant or an arrest results in a suspension of the license until the person is found innocent, in which case the license is retained, or convicted, in which case the license is revoked. Although it is not explicitly written into the bill, the validity of a permit would have to be verified at some time of purchase, possibly through a phone call by a gun seller to the Oregon State Police Department. If the permit is suspended or void, the purchase would not be granted. Thus, this does not take away any tool from law enforcement. If state law enforcement agencies are not communicating effectively regarding issuance and revocation of carrying permits, particularly through the established Oregon law enforcement data system, law-abiding citizens that would benefit from this legislation should not be punished. We agree that any communications issues should be addressed to ensure that law enforcement agencies have the proper information on carrying permits across the state. It's important to grant law enforcement the ability to focus on screening those firearms purchasers with no record on file by recognizing the thorough screening that right-to-carry persons have already undergone in good faith to the law. HB 2991 does just that. Thanks.
Thank you. And I would add, in looking at this, if we move this forward later, we want to be sure that the information is confidential so that I can't call the state police and say I'm a gun dealer. Does Rod Harder have a concealed handgun permit? They'd have to call up and say, I'm checking on Rod Harder permit number so-and-so, so the state police would know that they're actually looking at the permit that has been presented. So yeah. Thank you very much for the testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Stigler.
Just a quick question. I just want to make sure that there's some cross-the-board agreement here with the idea, because that was the only problem I had with these, was the verification of the validity of the CHL. I mean, if somebody's gone through that and they have a valid CHL, it's not suspended, not revoked, then I have no problem with this. But in those cases where that's the issue, I'm assuming there's some agreement here that those folks should not be able to go through this short-cutted process.
Chair Barker, I think that's exactly what we're trying to accomplish. And as Chair Barker said, if a person either at a gun show, being an individual or a dealer, calls the state police and says, I have a license in my hand and this is the number, that takes care of the privacy issue, and it also allows us to address the validity of the license.
And just follow up, I would think that it would make some sense to memorialize some of that process in this so that we're not guessing how that's supposed to occur.
I think we certainly need an amendment to make that clear.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. DeLashman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Brian DeLashman here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. We've taken no position on this bill, but let me give you just a little additional spin. I did have some membership of the Oregon Council of Police Association respond to this bill, and it wasn't plus or minus this bill. It was a side issue, which is, if you're going to go down this path, then why would you run a certified police officer that has already gone through a very heavy background check through having to purchase or have to go through the same background check for the sale or purchase of a firearm? So I would urge you that if this bill goes forward, we figure out some way in which Senior Trooper Andy Olson, if he wishes to purchase a handgun, doesn't have to pay the $50 and go or the fee and go through actually checking on that.
Mr. Cherry just lost my vote on that.
And I'll give him proper training so he knows how to shoot it straight.
Thank you.
Your valid point.
Next time you just tell your member to call his father-in-law and ask him ahead of time. So.
Yes, it was your son-in-law who called me about it.
But Mr. Chair, I think he raises a valid issue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lashman. Civil Hemp, please.
That's too funny.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center. I think that the previous witnesses have explained the bulk of my concern. I just would like to point out that when looking for the verification of the validity of licenses, also important to make sure that we're looking at whether or not there have been events that have occurred that would give grounds for a revocation of a license. And the witnesses previously mentioned misdemeanor convictions, but also being subject to a protective order, such as a stalking order or a restraint order. Those are also disqualifying events, and sometimes I think the tracking between those systems is not as clear or clean as it could be, and so we just want to make sure that we have some attention paid to that issue as well, because of course domestic violence perpetrators, if there are guns, the lethality of potential events increases. Again, don't mean to imply that bearers of gun licenses are a bad crowd. The opposite, we believe, is true, but just want to make sure that we take care of that tracking. So,
thank you very much for your input on that. Okay. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2991. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2682.
House Bill 2682 permits private bail companies to offer commercial security release. It directs the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules establishing a commercial surety licensing program.
Mr. Romaine, Mr. Bartlett, please. And Mr. Gardner.
What we own now?
First one. Bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's some testimony that's going to be passed out to you. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing the American Bail Coalition. I'm going to give you a brief overview, and then Mr. Bartlett, to my left, will read the entire thing into the record. So if you have a little time, we'll kind of get that done for you. We promise to be brief. Basically, what you have in the state of Oregon right now is a criminal justice system where there is no certainty of getting something done. And what we propose to you is to look at reinstituting a system that aids in the successful, if you would, prosecution of a legitimate criminal justice system. Right now in Oregon, commercial surety bail is not allowed. And what you have is a system called deposit bail, where the bail is set, you pay 10% to the court, you get out of jail, and whether you show up or not is rather problematic. We've done a little bit of research and found that the failure to appear rate in the state of Oregon is approximately 30%. In other words, 30% of the time people do not appear for a criminal trial. The cost to the system of that is enormous. Los Angeles did the study 12 years ago and found the number to be about $1,300 per failure to appear. The cost of the system of the time for the police officer, for the court, the witnesses, everything else is enormous. In the state of Washington and the state of Idaho, they have commercial surety bail. Surety bail has a return rate or failure to appear rate of approximately 4%. So the difference is enormous. What we're talking about is over the past years, you've had an average of about 50,000 failures to appear every year. If you multiply that, even by a lesser figure than $1,300, by, say, $1,000, that means you are, your expense that you could, if you got that number down, is somewhere around $50 million. That's a lot of money. We are not asking you to pass any particular bill today. What we're asking you to do is put together a study group that would composed of a few of you and members of the general community who would like to work on this to put together a system that will work for Oregon. It would not replace the current system. It would be an overlay that would be available to judges to use if they so desired in particular cases. For example, if somebody has a previous failure to appear, they've shown an ability and a desire to not comply with the system. If they get caught up in the system again, that might be a proper time for commercial bail. If somebody has a very high-end felony where you really want to make sure if they are out that there's somebody to babysit, you might want to use this kind of system versus your existing system. We have spoken with the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Court Administrator's Office. They both would love to work with us on the system. They expressed no opinion about it, but we've had a number of meetings with them, and they've been extremely productive in both gathering information and trying to follow, in effect, follow the money and follow, set up the system. With that, I'm going to shut up. I'll let Dennis Bartlett talk. He'll introduce himself and tell you a little bit about himself and give you a little bit of background.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Before we do that, I wonder if Mr. Romaine, if you could help me with the conditional propensity score and the probabilities on page 101. Do I have to pass to be able to do that formula to be a part of this work group? Because it's been a long time since I've had calculus and algebra and statistics.
Chair, Representative Cameron, I am the front man for this group, and the person on my left will explain that in detail. And yes, the test will be a day after tomorrow. So if you want to show up a day after tomorrow, we'll be happy to test you on Saturday. The test is Saturday.
That's a University of Chicago study, I think.
Obviously.
Read the executive summary.
Also, to Mr. Romaine, as a longtime person in this building, what is the rule about what you give legislators that they will actually read? It's a one-pager.
Mr. Chair, I have to respond to that. Representative Krieger, I will bet you that there are actually a couple of people on this committee who will read this entire thing by the time we get together again.
I have to talk to you.
Yeah, there is.
Well, you've got a reputation.
Please.
Thank you. Chairman Barker, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to address the committee in support of the utilization of commercial surety bonds for the release of defendants pending trial. My name is Dennis Bartlett. I'm actually from Washington State originally. I have the great misfortune now of living in the other Washington. I spent a number of years here. I was over at Sheridan when it was a Jesuit and a bishop. I spent four great years from 1960 to 1964 overlooking the Amhill Valley. I then went to Gonzaga University, went to USC, went to work for the CIA, ended up at the Criminal Division Department of Justice working for Interpol, from which I retired in 1993, and then I went to work for these guys.
I am the executive director of the American Bail Coalition, which is an association of bail and insurance companies. Our companies write about 20% of the bail in the United States. One of our companies, International Fidelity, has been doing this for over a century. There are several kinds of pretrial release, but the one we're talking about today is the surety bond, which guarantees the appearance of a defendant in court upon the failure of which the surety pays the court the full amount of the bond. Surety bail is the only pretrial method wherein a third party, by means of a written undertaking, financially guarantees the court to the court the appearance of the defendant. Purpose of bail. According to the Supreme Court, the sole purpose of bail is to get the defendant to court. It's not to sweat plea bargains, punish defendants, enrich the state through forfeitures, manage jail populations, or release the highest number of defendants possible. Although we all know this happens throughout the United States. But in achieving this primary end, the most efficient method of pretrial release is secured release. That is, release on commercial surety bonds. And the U.S. government itself has confirmed this. The Bureau of Justice Statistics, using 15 years of data, compared the track records of all different methods, including surety bail, and came up with the conclusion that, compared to release on recognizance, defendants on financial release were more likely to make all scheduled court appearances. Defendants released on an unsecured bond or as part of an emergency release were most likely to have a bench warrant issued because they failed to appear in court. And there's a ton of academic studies attached to this telephone book, which will confirm that. I know a primary concern of yours is it going to cost you anything? Is it going to cost the state anything? We think it's going to cost the state nothing. In fact, we think the state stands to gain some revenue. Commercial bail agents are, first of all, private entities. They bear all their own costs. No tax dollars go towards their operation.
And what is the current cost today of the current system?
I'll skip over this, but Paul mentioned that it is the great number of failures to appear, the skipping of court dates, cost of no-shows, unvacated and uncollected forfeitures, and the cost of jail cells for recommitted skips. As he mentioned, we picked up through the Oregon Judicial Information Network the figure of an average of 50,000 FTAs annually, failures to appear annually in Oregon. This translates to about almost a 30% failure to appear rate. When you calculate an FTA, it's the money lost by all the people that are showing up except the principal. It's the attorneys, the defense attorneys, the DA, the police officers, you name it. Everybody that's supposed to be there shows up. The principal doesn't show up. That time is wasted. They move on to the next case in the docket. As Paul mentioned, the L.A. study came up with a figure of cost of an FTA of $1,300. Now, not every jurisdiction in Oregon is going to have that cost, but whatever it comes up with, multiply it by 50,000, and you're looking at a big loss. Right up front, the commercial bail would stop this hemorrhage of FTAs. From industry records in other states, about 8 out of 100 defendants out in a surety bond will skip. We will retrieve all but about 2 of those. It's a commercial bail. Commercial bail is basically an insurance policy written in the favor of the state. If the defendant does not appear and a forfeiture judgment is executed, commercial bail pays the amount of the bond. And if the commercial bail entity doesn't pay, they'll lose their certificate of authority. They'll be cut off from writing bail bonds until they make up the difference. The commercial bail has a very powerful financial incentive to recover the absconder, not only so they won't have to pay the forfeiture, but if that falls through, to keep them from going out of business. In contrast, under your current system, if the defendant absconds, the state is out 90% of the bond if you use a 10% deposit system, and 100% if you use the other one, like OR releases. Under commercial bonds, the number of forfeitures would be reduced right up front because of the lower FTA rates. Another source of revenue would be one licensing fees, and in addition, insurance companies pay premium taxes. So another question arises in this respect. Commercial bail. Okay, you're very efficient in recovering fugitives. Are you going to clog up our already overcrowded jails with all the skips that you recover? Among those recovered, a number will be bonded out. As I mentioned, there are probably only about 8 out of 100 will skip. Some of those cases will be just guys who overslept. You can reschedule those people right away, and they're actually sometimes rebonded out. So I think the algorithm would work out that the cohort of return skips is more than offset by the numbers who will not be confined while awaiting trial. Furthermore, the cost of recovering fugitives is borne solely by the bonding agent and not by the state. Under the current system, the state must either recover the fugitive by means of law enforcement resources or, in the case of extradition, pay a healthy fee. It is not the intent of this legislation to exchange the current system and replace it with commercial bail. That would be totally unrealistic and cause a severe dislocation in the court system and criminal justice system. What is before the legislature is, one, whether this option should function at no cost to the state, and I think that that's the case, whether it would contribute to public safety, and I believe that's the case, and if authorized, what would be the best way to integrate it into the system. I don't know how many of you know that the pretrial services community is stands in opposition to commercial bail. As a matter of fact, their national association, called the National Association of Pretrial Service Agencies, has a standard and aspires to wipe out all commercial bail all throughout the United States and replace it with government bureaucracies. Hence, there is a tension between the two. However, both of us share the same goal, which is to release all defendants who are not a threat to public safety or a flight risk. Competition between the two systems is wasteful and distracting, and furthermore, it's totally unnecessary. Example, about a decade ago, at the request of the judges of Harris County, that's Houston, Texas, the American Bail Coalition teamed up with the Harris County Pretrial Service Agency. Pretrial services supervised defendants who were then released on a commercial surety bond. The result, FTAs have been reduced to 2%. At an annual meeting of the National Association of Pretrial Service Agencies held in Milwaukee last fall, the number of attendees who reported teaming up with commercial bail doubled from the previous year. Although many in the pretrial service community oppose this trend, almost nobody in the commercial bail system does. Hence, in adopting the commercial surety bail option and integrate it into your current system here in Oregon, you'd have not only a chance really to enhance the rights of the defendant, but also enhance public safety as well. Thanks for your attention. I'm available for questions at your convenience.
Okay, Mr. Gardewise, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, very briefly. I'm appearing today for Aladdin Bail Bond Company, which is America's largest provider of bail bond services, focused on service in California, Idaho, and Washington. 50 locations in those states, and we serve approximately 90,000 customers per year. We're in support of this this bill, and we understand, Mr. Chairman, that it would be your intention to convene a work group to fine-tune the legislation, and we'd request to be a part of that work group.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel?
If I could chime in, just one little thing. There's one thing that we've sort of left out, and that's the operation of bail itself. Right now in the state of Oregon, you can't take anybody. A bail bondsman cannot operate. So what that means, practically speaking, a couple of things. First of all, if a bail bondsman from Washington State goes to California, picks somebody up, they don't dare fly them back because they don't want to have an emergency landing in the state of Oregon because you've got a kidnapping charge. You have to literally drive out to Nevada and up and around. So it's sort of a pocket. The second thing is you become a dumping ground. Because the bail bondsmen from other states can't come in to Oregon to pick somebody up, in effect, Oregon gets the folks from those states, Idaho, Washington, our neighbor states, who know it's a secure place. As long as they don't get caught up in the justice system, then they've pretty much got to get out of jail free card. So the system's broken right now. We gave Legislative Council a 70-page bill. They looked at us, got scared, and gave you what you have in front of you. But what we did was say, we need to get some minds together and figure out a better way to do this, because we know the thing we know for sure is what we're doing now is not working. So that's what we want to do. We want to put it together and work with you and craft the best system possible.
Okay. Thank you, and I'll talk to my members of the committee and see, so we have, people have the time to be able to do that. Some people may or may not have the time to do that. And we look forward to working with you so we don't have Dog the Bounty Hunter filming over again. We don't want that.
Yeah.
And
We were going to dress in wigs and chains and stuff.
The failed to appear costs you speak of, I know from personal experience how large those are. The many times I went to court, and under the contract I was working under in the city of Portland, I got 6 hours pay, 4 hours of time, and have to show up. So I'd be there 5 minutes, there'd be a fail to appear, I'd be dismissed. When I left work in 2001, that was $218.16. Today's salary for that same job is $274.03. And the city can't afford that. The officer's time is important to them as well.
That's just for the police officer.
That's just the police officer. The attorney, the district attorney has a salary higher than the police officer. The judge is higher. The court attendance, I mean, those are huge costs. And then I would see, stop somebody in the street, and they say, we have a warrant for fail to appear. Write them a citation to appear. and so there would be another cycle. And the system is broken. And the idea that we've spoke about where somebody would have to have at least one fail to appear before they'd even be eligible for this and have judicial discretion so a judge could take a look at it and decide. So there's protections built in. And I hope that we'll be able to, our work group will be able to come back with something that we could really take a good look at it. We'll get that done in the near future.
Great. Thank you.
Any other comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Safe trip. The test will be on Saturday, Representative Cameron.
Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2682. And if by chance anybody is here for 2814, that's being moved over. There were some problems with that. We're going to fix before we bring it before you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2810.
House Bill 2810 allows a court to impose fines to enforce a provision of a parenting plan. A Dash 1 amendment was brought in today, and according to the Dash 1 amendment, it would provide that the court could impose a fine for the violation that occurs after the party has already been ordered to attend a parenting class.
Mr. Minahan, please.
Matt Minahan. I represent Dad's America. And actually, before I get started, President Krieger, this is my third session, and I spent about an hour and a half trying to get this on one page and was almost successful. But I do have some written testimony. Well, we do have an amendment that we put in that just actually came out today on this bill, and just to forewarn you, it may grow into a Dash 2 amendment. I met with the Judicial Department yesterday and came up with some language. It came up, and it didn't exactly represent that, and I'll be working with some of the opposition, and so, again, we may have a Dash 2 coming. But what we're trying to do with the amendment is actually create another level of consequences instead of just having a $500 fine in areas where there's applicable parenting classes available to maybe impose a parenting class before the fine, because we feel that maybe a $500 fine might be taking away monies originally allocated for the child, and that that a parenting class might be a better option. The goal of this bill is really to create a violation to parents, and you know, I represent dads, and so I use terms moms and dads a lot, but I think it's I'd like to point out that we recognize that violations on this issue come from both sides. And what we're trying to do is put some teeth into the parenting plans. I represent dads, and the negative thing about, or the bad thing about this whole process is dads seem to have a stigma out there that they don't, you know, they get a divorce and they don't really want to see their kids and they don't really care, and that hurts us because the reality is there is a lot of parents or a lot of fathers out there who do try very hard to see their kids, and they go through the system and they actually get beaten down, and it's frustrating for them, and so they give up. I was one of those dads at one time. I chose to do some things about it. But what we're trying to do is put some teeth into these. So when a father actually shows up at the door and has went through the process and has a court-ordered parenting plan, and for whatever reason that it's not being adhered to, the police really can't do anything. The judges feel that they have done all they can do. So we're trying to design something that that creates some sort of consequence, and an automatic consequence. A parenting class would be perfect, and you know, a mandatory parenting class for the violating parent. And when it's clear, I want to point out too that our amendment may address what a violation is. We're not talking about the plan said 8 o'clock and you showed up at 8:15, so therefore you violated the plan, or maybe the pass was snowy or it was a hurricane that day. We're trying to address real violations and put some teeth into this. It might also be brought up too that there's already a court, you know, contempt of court order in place that could remedy this issue. We feel that a mandatory parenting class might be a better solution. It is expensive to do that. Quite frankly, that process hasn't been working, and we think this remedy might actually save some costs. And if we knew that, or if the violating parent knew that there was some sort of automatic consequence, maybe there would be fewer consequences. So that's what we're trying to accomplish in this bill. Again, you may see a dash 2 coming forward, and I would certainly entertain any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Ms. Hebb?
Members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center. As you know, the Law Center represents low-income clients throughout Oregon. A number of our clients are parents, and we do a lot of work in the family law arena. We agree that the enforcement of parenting time plans is a difficult process for parents, and there's not a perfect solution here. Mr. Minahan's proposal, I checked myself as against the bill because we were concerned about the implications of that. I do think that we can work out an agreement, and I think the basic concept is that there is a desire to add an additional tool to the court's current authority to provide sanctions or ramifications when there's been a violation of a parenting plan. The court already has very broad authority under 107.434 to order a variety of different ramifications when there's been a violation of parenting plan. They can order attendance at parenting classes. They can order changes in the parenting plan in the time that's allocated from one parent to another. They can order changes in custody if there is a serious enough violation. They can order make-up parenting time, and they can also order a posting of a bond or security. There are a couple of other provisions as well that are set out. The concept of adding the authority to order fines we don't think is a bad one. I have a little bit of a concern from the perspective of low-income parents that ought to be limited to circumstances in which there has been a willful or a purposeful violation. And I think Mr. Minahan has expressed a desire, an interest in talking about that, so hopefully we could come back with a consensus amendment. Available and effective enforcement of parenting time plans is very important both to custodial as well as to non-custodial parents, and it's vital that we have a system that works for families. So if this is a tool that can help with that, so long as it's narrowly focused on willful or purposeful violations, then the imposition of a fine might be something that would help. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead, please.
Ms. Hebb,
would it be your contention that current contempt powers of the court are not sufficient to enforce these kind of things?
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Stiegler, you can go through the court system through the contempt process set out in Chapter 33 to get enforcement for violations of parenting plans, and you can have impositions of fines through that process. I think that the sort of provision of fines as an element of a family law proceeding, maybe there's an efficiency there. If it helps, we think, you know.
Don't we then essentially, follow up, Mr. Chair, essentially turn domestic relations into a quasi-criminal kind of situation? I mean, fines is the step from, I mean, what has to go into finding the process and procedure to impose a fine for a violation of, you know, a court order. I mean, I can, you take this on down. I mean, we're talking civil law here, and the contempt process, I understand and agree, is a fairly, can be a laborious process, but it also can be pretty powerful. I mean, you can get attorney fees imposed, you can get all sorts of financial, you know, I guess what you would call quasi kind of financial, financial fine kind of things imposed, but I have a real problem with just a provision in here. I mean, then we go into contract law. You violate a provision of the contract. Granted, there can be some remunerative kind of things, but calling it a fine per se, it carries a whole different connotation with it.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Stiegler, I agree those are legitimate concerns. I think from our perspective, we would not object to adding the potential for a fine if it were limited to circumstances in which the violations were willful and purposeful. And especially the judge would have the discretion. There is due process afforded because there is, you know, notice and hearing before the imposition of any of these determinations. So, but I appreciate your concern, and I do agree that the court can do that currently through the contempt process. So,
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
In this area as well, I guess, you know, when Mr. Minahan made comment about a police officer comes out and there's nothing they can do, well, I certainly don't want to see this process denigrated down to a police officer issuing a citation for, like, a traffic violation, what would essentially be akin to that in these kind of proceedings. I mean, I would be very opposed to any process that doesn't involve the full and complete review by the court that these kinds of things only would come about and as a result of a full-fledged hearing process.
And Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, I can't speak to that. In 107.434, there is a specific, there has to be a petition filed, there is a notice then sent to the other party, there's a hearing set, and then the court would determine the facts. And so there is that process that's required before there would be any imposition of either a fine if this were to move forward or a change in parenting plan or any of the other things that the court currently has the discretion to do in these circumstances.
And thank you. And I appreciate you the effort you two are going to make to work something out. I've been the cop there, and there's nothing you can do. And it, oftentimes, the one partner that has the children, suddenly the other spouse, the ex-spouse, shows up with the new girlfriend who was the wife's former best friend. And so things aren't always rational, and there's a lot of emotion involved in those cases. And sometimes the divorce came about due to lack of communication here under the most strained conditions they're trying to communicate, not very successfully. And I like the idea that you're trying to come to some kind of a plan that will help discourage the conflict. And sometimes it's because a check was late, so somebody said, I didn't get my check, you're not getting to see the kids. Courts are going to be only open 4 days a week, so how are you going to get in to get a hearing? And all these things. So I really appreciate your effort at getting this fixed before it's a problem. Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Krieger.
What was that relationship that you cited about somebody's best friend is now the
new girlfriend?
Oh, we don't do that in rural Oregon.
Yeah. That's because you're heavily armed there.
Good. Good.
Close the public hearing on 28N. Open a work session on House Bill 2308.
Other things in rural Oregon.
Yeah.
House Bill 2308 allows a trustee, personal representative, or executor to apply to the Oregon Department of Revenue for determination of the amount of inheritance tax owed. Following payment, it allows for a discharge from further tax liability to be issued. We have a minimal expenditure impact statement. You'll note that the revenue impact statement is indeterminate and notes the possible loss of revenue in cases where a tax liability is misestimated by the state and therefore they've lost recourse to go and seek the remainder.
Okay. Is there any discussion about this bill? Are you concerned?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2308 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2308 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Oh, aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Is there any objection to this being on the consent calendar?
No.
We'll put it on consent. You close the door. Here is closed. Pass the bill. The work session is closed on 2308. Open a work session on 2343.
House Bill 2343 modifies the definition of mentally incapacitated as it applies to sex offenses. You have in front of you the Dash 2 Amendment. The Dash 2 Amendment simply addresses line 16, page 1, and would put a period after the word offense and delete the remaining lines 17 through 19. We have an, again, somewhat of an indeterminate fiscal impact statement and no revenue.
Okay. The Dash 2, right?
Yes.
We
have not adopted them.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2343 be sent to the floor with due pass recommendation.
We need to move the amendment to
I move Dash 1, Dash 2,
Dash
2,
two
into 2343.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I ask for a motion to move this.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2343 with Dash 2 into the floor with due pass recommendation.
With a
referral to Ways and Means. I didn't read.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2343 with the due pass forward through Ways and Means as amended. Any discussion?
I thought it was down below.
My mistake. Remember to me, that's my mistake. It's 2476 that has the subsequent referral.
Okay.
Yes, I'll reopen. So, reopen House Bill 2343.
Session on 2343. We got the Dash 2 in.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I change the to delete the referral. We need to.
Just go ahead and just move. I'll accept a motion for House Bill 2343 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2343 with the Dash 2 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2343 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Agreement to call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Now I'll ask Representative Gelser to carry that. I'll open a House bill on our work session on House Bill 2476. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Now we got it. Good job.
House Bill 2476 enhances the penalty for sex abuse in the second degree when the offender is age 21 or older and the minor victim's athletic coach. It expands the definition of sex abuse 2 to include sexual contact when the offender is 21 or older and is the minor victim's athletic coach. This one does have a fiscal impact statement. It should be before all of the members. It has no revenue impact. It's an estimated $136,000 for the 09-11 biennium and $504,000 for the 11 through 13 biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnack.
I move House Bill 2476 be sent to refer to the Ways and Means Committee from this committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnack moves 2476 with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Krieger.
I can't figure out the revenue impact with the number of cases that you have that would ever get up to that number. I'm not confident of that number at all. Maybe we need to have a note to Ways and Means to question that and have them verify those figures.
And yeah, Coach, we're talking Coach.
And I would also hope that should we pass this bill, that would be a discouragement to coaches to violate their trust.
You bet.
And reduce the number even further.
Yep.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Martin.
I would also like to state I'm going to vote and support this bill. It's a good bill, although I can find no principled reason why coaches are basically... Is why a coach committing a vicious crime is any more egregious than a parent or a teacher or anyone else in similar positions of trust. The underlying problem is that sex abuse, too, is not sufficiently high category. I recognize that in these times that we can't address the underlying problem, but I'd love to do that at some point.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Martin. Coach. Yeah. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Excused.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Okay, thank you. Right. Well, he won't. I mean, it's going Ways and Means.
Yeah.
If it comes out of Ways and Means, we'll ask Representative
Winger
to carry the bill. Open a public hearing on a work session on House Bill 2463.
House Bill 2463 allows a person with a concealed weapon permit issued by another state to carry the weapon in Oregon. You have a -1 amendment in front of you. The -1 amendment would include persons who may carry handguns in their home state without a license or permit, and it adds that to all the relevant sections.
And that there's two states that have that, Vermont and I think Alaska, allow people to carry without a permit.
Can I just ask Council to repeat that? I want to make sure I understood it.
Sure. The -1 part?
Yeah.
Sorry. It's added in the provision that if a person is allowed to carry a gun in their home state without having a license and permit, they also would receive reciprocity here in Oregon.
That is Vermont.
Alaska and Vermont.
So we would allow residents of those states to carry concealed weapons
with the -1
in Oregon.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move -1s in the House Bill 2463.
We have a motion to move the House the -1 amendments in the House Bill 2463, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wish to state that I cannot support the -1. I support this bill. I think it is a good bill. I would love to be able to vote yes on the floor. I view the -1s as being a significant substantive change, and if this bill is amended, I will be forced to vote no.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion?
I think I have the same view, Mr. Chair.
Likewise.
And I would as well, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Call the roll, please. On the -1s.
Representative Barton?
No.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
No.
Vice Chair Stigler?
No.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. -1s are adopted.
Chair, I move House Bill 2463 with the -1 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2463 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
As amended.
Are there any further discussion? Representative Barton.
Again, Mr. Chair, sorry to belabor the point. I really do support this bill. I think it is a good bill. I cannot support it as amended.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Mr.
And Representative Smith.
Yeah, likewise, Mr. Chair, and I don't know, I know that this year, and this is obviously my first rodeo, but I know that this year the rules for creating alternatives, you know, minority reports, whatever they're called, are now different, that we have to have an amendment in advance. I don't know if this is a time when it would be allowed, but I do need to vote no on the bill as it is. If there were, it would love to have on the floor an option to vote where it was a, you know, it, from my view, a slightly more balanced bill.
I will recognize that you're introducing a concern in possible minority report.
Okay.
And we'll recognize that if you want to move one forward.
Great.
I'll recognize
that. And I don't know the procedures, but I just want to ask.
Well,
thanks.
Well, what you're supposed to do is present the motion before the committee, or to, you wouldn't even have to do it in formal committee. You could hand them out. I'm recognizing that you did that in formal committee so that you're on record. It's having this opposition and notification that you may possibly do a minority report.
Okay, thanks very much.
And council can help you with that. Or
great, thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, if I may clarify on this minority report issue, the amendments would have had to have been looked at here today, right? So they could go back. And in other words, if there's no amendments that we've looked at, you can't.
Well, they've expressed concern that they would like to cancel the amendment.
Okay, so that would serve as the minority report, the original bill. Fine. Okay, got it.
And I want to make it possible, and we spoke about this at the first session, for any member of this committee, any two members of this committee, that have a concern, that I'll do everything I can to assist them to get that through and not try to stall any minority opposition from anybody. Okay. Do we have a motion before us? Okay.
No.
We have a motion before us to move House Bill 2463 as amended to the floor with the new pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
No.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
No.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
No.
Vice Chair
Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Krieger, would you carry that bill for us?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Close the work session on 2463. Open the work session on House Bill 2498.
House Bill 2498 creates the crime of endangering an aircraft in the second degree. It expands the Port of Portland's policing authority to all property owned, operated, maintained, or controlled by the Port of Portland. You have as well a dash one in front of you. The original bill has no fiscal or revenue impact, or minimal fiscal impact. I'm sorry.
We'll take care of that. We're not going to put them in dash one. Okay. We'll take care of it later. All right. We're not going to move the dash ones today. And I want to make a statement about this bill before I put it to a vote. And that is, there was great concern over regulating concealed handguns by the Port of Portland. People with concealed handgun permits at the Port of Portland. We've worked that out. They've changed that. They've made it clear that that is no longer part of their administrative rules. They've taken the offending sign off the front door of the airport. And we want to make it clear, though, that anytime we pass a bill, we in no way want to allow anybody to think they can interfere with concealed handgun permit laws in Oregon. And Representative Krieger.
And Mr. Chair, if you recall, I questioned the airport police chief and their lobby as to what their intent was, and they verified that they did not intend to do that in the future, and they acknowledged that the state did have the right for preemption, and they did not.
Yes, thank you. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Olson?
Aye.
Representative
Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. I'm not sure that Representative Krieger would like me to.
I'll let you do it.
Okay.
Portland's airport, Portland's in your area.
Not in my county, but it's in my area. And in my heart.
I'm happy to carry it, Mr. Chair.
You would like to carry it?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I got to have some questions ready for that.
Smith, is there any further business coming before the committee today? Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.